Welcome back to Dear Skylar, where I talk to all kinds of amazing people about topics that I'm asked about as a transgender educator and activist. Things like mental health and sexuality, gender, race, sports, and so many things in between and beyond. I'm frequently asked about what my life was like before I transitioned. A lot of times people will ask me how I feel about looking at old photos of myself, what I felt like as I walked the world as what people perceived was a woman. How did I feel about myself from before? So today we'll be addressing the following question. How do trans people feel about how we were before? Before we dive into this conversation and I welcome our guest, I want to make sure that we understand this whole before and after characterization of trans people can sometimes be, and really what I mean, most of the time, if not always, be incomprehensive. I am not a before and an after. I'm a during and during and a during. What I mean by that is that oftentimes our journeys as trans people are sensationalized as before transition and after transition. And there's so much more to us than that. So back to our question, how do trans people feel about how we were before? An amazing individual to help us address this question is Ezra Michel. Ezra, I have never met you in person. Well, actually, no, I have met you in person.
We
hadn't spent time together.
No, we didn't.
So I'm really glad that you're here today because that I almost said we never met because I feel like I saw you for like 2 seconds that day.
Yeah, I introduced you on stage.
Yeah. And that was it.
That was it. Yeah, we have one photo together, but the lighting is horrible. And it was like the background was the wall of inside of a trailer and it was ugly. Mm-hmm. And so I hate that that's our only photo together.
Okay, well, we're going to take another photo.
We have to.
There's going to be a whole video, actually, of us.
Aww, so this is being filmed.
Anyway, so I feel like I'm very excited, I guess is what I'm trying to say, to actually get to sit down with you and talk to you. Because I feel like we didn't really get to connect. That's also during New York City Pride. So that was such like a mess.
That was a mess. You're right.
Yeah. So I'm stoked that you're here, that we get to actually talk.
Yeah.
I know a lot about you because I followed you for a long time, but followers or listeners right now might not. So could you give us a little intro, name and pronouns and a little about who you are?
I'm Ezra Michel. I use he, him pronouns primarily, but any pronouns are like fine. I'm a trans mask musician, hairdresser, graphic designer, entrepreneur, clothing brand man, barber. I do a lot of things.
Yeah.
I have ADHD, so I get hyper focused on different things at different times in my life. And then, you know, I'm 27. So that happened over and over and over again. So now they're all kind of coming to fruition and like, you know, having like a kind of a foundation. So, yeah. So I have a lot of like little things I do. I'm a crafty guy.
I know that from watching you online. Well, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions. So thanks for sharing about yourself. And I think that I feel like a lot of us trans folks I don't know if multi-hyphenate is the right word, but we do a lot of things.
Yeah.
Lots of things that going on. And I think maybe that some of that survival, maybe some of that is just art is like pouring through. It sounds like for you, like you're just an artist through and through.
I'd say so. I think that, you know, when you spend so much time unlearning social constructs or like disregarding them in my case,
that disregarding instead of unlearning.
I'm just, well, cause I was always like such a little rebel as a kid. I was very much a nonconformist my whole life. So I think that growing up, I just was so comfortable going against the grain and not doing what everyone else seemed to be doing. And so when everyone was choosing one thing to do, I was like, you don't have to do that. Like, do you not realize that like there are so many options? And only now I feel like I'm really benefiting from that mindset. But for so long I was seen as like just some whatever, like aimless bum. Or, you know, just clearly somebody who was afflicted with ADHD, you know.
Well, I have a lot of friends and also clients, and I know a lot of people have ADHD, and I think that's like a very common feeling of like being told that one is worthless because they're bouncing from one thing to the next.
Yeah.
And I've seen so much beauty in like being able to do so much and so many different things. And I think sometimes it can be painful for the person because they don't know which is the thing they want to do. I have the opposite problem where I get so sucked into one thing and I can't do anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm not good at switching tasks and I'm not good at doing new things because I looked at the bottom of a pool for 18 years of my life and just did that repeatedly for 20 hours every week. So I'm the opposite of that. Yeah. That's also not always great.
Sure. Yeah. There's a balance to find.
Exactly. But I think there's beauty in both. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like for me, I really don't get sick of doing the same thing on repeat.
Yeah.
And you know, for people that have ADHD, there's this other, you know, amazing thing where you can switch so many times. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have to dive too deep into that unless you want to, but I loved what you said, where you said you didn't start reaping the benefits or really kind of benefiting from the way that that has impacted your life until recently. And how did that shift happen?
I think time, you know, like if you cycle through a pattern so many times, then you're able to like focus enough time to actually make it happen over the course of a few years, you know? And so for like the music stuff, I've been writing songs since I was 10 years old.
I've seen videos of you from when you were a kid.
Yeah, I've been writing songs forever. Mm. I've been performing them and singing them since high school. Mm. And like, I used to play at farmer's markets in Santa Barbara on the street and just put a little hat down and just start playing. My mom used to take me to farmer's market to play. She was dating this like white guy who made Native American flutes. Yeah.
I'm cringing for anybody not watching.
It was so but he was trying to bond with me and he gave me a Native American flute and I was like 10. Right. So I was like, cool. And I just like started playing it. And then they were like, you're good. You should go to farmer's market. So they just took me, like I made like $50 like doing that. Santa Barbara. So
nice,
rich people are just like, sure. But yeah, I've just always been doing that. And then, you know, over the course of my life, it's gotten me to a place where now I have a bunch of singles on Spotify that I learned how to produce music. I taught myself how
to do. You do that all yourself? You don't have like a team?
Not every song, but like Mad of My Dreams, which was the one that like really kind of established my career as a musician. That I self-produced. I wrote that in one night and produced it and sent it out for distribution all in one.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Sounds also, like I said, there's a lot of people in my life with ADHD. That sounds very attached to that.
Yeah. Yep. It was pretty manic. It was awesome.
Wow. That's, that's amazing. I'll make a confession to you, which is that I love, it's not a confession. That sounds weird, but it feels intimate to say. So that's why I'm saying it's a confession.
Go for it.
I have definitely left like videos of you playing music, like whatever. What's the word I'm looking for? Not playing music because you're, what is it? Making music?
Making music?
Musicking.
Musicking?
Singing and playing your guitar. Yeah. Sorry, I'm stumbling on this one, but I've left those videos just on my phone, just leaving it there, just listening. And there's like, first of all, there's just something very calming and intimate about the way that you sing. And I think for me, it also, it's like part, I don't know how, this doesn't sound right, but I'm going to say it. It reminds me of my childhood somehow in like a really beautiful, like grounding way. Because I think that, I don't know, there's so much of my childhood I didn't see. And I think that one of the things I wanted to, the main thing I wanted to talk to you about was your connection to your childhood. There's a video of you, sorry, I'm going in these circles, but I promise it's all related.
I'm following.
There's a video of you talking about how you refer to your childhood self still with she, her pronouns. Mm-hmm. And the first time I watched it, there was something that sort of prickled in me where I was like, she, her pronouns. And then you said, but the line is something like, but I was bullied with using he, him pronouns. Mm-hmm. And you know, little me didn't want to be called he, him pronouns. And there's just this like, there's this reverence for who and how you were at the time that I think we don't see. And that I think was almost healing to watch, even though I still use he, him pronouns for me as a kid, cause that's what I wanted then.
Right.
And so I've kept that, but to see you say that there's this healing nature. I can't think of a better word. I'm gonna stop talking. Curious what you think about this.
No. Yeah. I think, Well, I think I have a very deep connection to my inner child. Mm. My inner child is the thing that it's like my beacon, my like the lighthouse guiding me back to myself. And I think that I vary with the pronoun usage with younger me. Mm. I think, you know, with that video, at that time I was having some really intense realizations about pronouns and referring back to myself and all that stuff. But I think, you know, I can understand also that I didn't have the language to understand that I was trans at that time. And I so badly wanted to be a boy. And it felt like taunting when they would call me a boy because I knew I couldn't be one. Mm. And then it was like heartbreaking to hear him and secretly
and
wish.
Access.
Yeah. And secretly wish that was like was real, but it was a joke. And so it hurt. And so I'd say, I'm a girl. But really it was complicated. There's layers. But I was the coolest kid. Mm. And I didn't feel like anybody knew it. Mm. And so I think that
I can feel that in the music. Like that's what I'm feeling. Like in the music, I can feel like you're clearly not a child anymore.
No.
And I can feel the child that's there. And I think that is so powerful. Yeah. And it is something that I think as a trans person who never got to see himself, you know, in the media and sports and photos and music.
Yeah.
Every like queer artist that I get to listen to, some like I'm not even like a big music person, to be quite honest with you. Mm-hmm. I don't like music, which is weird to say. We'll get into that later, maybe, but I'm not a big music person. But mm-hmm. queer artists, especially trans mask artists, which there aren't that many of, it seems.
No.
Make me ball. I don't even need to like the music. I do actually like your music. I love acoustic music. Yeah. So I love your music, like objectively.
Thanks.
But there's another layer that it's like. I don't know. I get to like spend a little time with like little Skylar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel you. I think that I definitely am tapping into something when I'm performing. I think about what I'd be impressed by when I was a kid and when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. I was really impressed by folks who were unapologetic and shameless and had a very clear understanding of who they were and were just themself, like just all in. And I think that above everything, that's my priority. And it just so happens that that led me to transition, that led me to be a content creator and be the person I am today, get sober, work on myself in this way, because I just want to embody whatever this is, you know, so much. And really that's like, little me, you know, I mean, I was so misunderstood as a kid. Trans kids are often so misunderstood. And back then, you know, it wasn't even like, I don't think that it was even a thought in my parents' minds that I might be a trans person, a trans kid, you know, I was just like a tomboy or whatever. And that always felt so stupid. I was like, who the heck is Tom? I was like, that's not my name. Why would you call me that? Like, what? Because I'm wearing jeans? Like, chill, you know? But yeah, like that energy of just like knowing who I was, that's what I like covet the most about myself, I think.
When you said that you said, whatever this is, I want to embody it.
Yeah.
What it made me think of is actually, so you have a scar just like mine on your chest or two, I guess. I think yours isn't joined in the middle.
Yeah, no, they're
okay. So mine's joined in the middle, but you got separate scars. Uh-huh. Anyways, we both have mastectomy scars.
Yeah.
And you tattooed yours over with a line. And the first time that's actually what actually first drew me to your page. Now I'm remembering is I saw that you had the lines on your, like I saw that you had drawn with ink, those lines on your chest. And I immediately, again, admitting this, I scrolled through your account until I could find when you didn't have the lines.
Totally. Yeah.
And because I wanted to know why you did it. I wanted to know what you said about when you did it.
Did I even say anything. Sometimes I give no context whatsoever. And then I'm just like, they'll figure it out.
I think you did make a post about it. Cool. I don't know if it was super long. I think I knew when I saw you I think it was probably maybe 30 posts after that I found your account or so. I think it was evident that it was part of your pride.
Yeah.
And I assumed that. Why else would somebody get those scars tattooed that way?
Right.
But I want to know what happened for you as it happened. And so I'm going to ask you that now. I'm curious, kind of, to me, my scar is one of the most important parts of my body. And it feels like this, just this gift that nobody can take from me. And people have tried, right? Even trans people have said, oh, you can make your scar lighter, Skylar. You can make your scar less purple. My scar is especially dark and it's especially thick. And I love it. And I've never once wanted it to go away.
Right.
And I love that it turns purple when I'm cold. And I have so much love for my scar. It's like, it is, to me, it's my story written in bold across my chest. And I'm so proud of my history. And so when I saw that you got yours tattooed, to me, it was like, I assumed it was the same. And I'm curious if you could say more about it.
Definitely. It is also a very important part of my body. Probably the most important thing that I have. It's my favorite tattoo. Mm. I have so many and it's just, it's so simple. And I had a trans artist draw the lines for me.
Oh, amazing.
And I wanted it to be
That's amazing.
Really special. You know, like I was like, once I had the thought, because so my scars were fading, my surgeon who did my revision surgery. So I had two top surgeries. The first one I had was incredibly botched. Mm. My nipples were like on my rib cage in my armpit. It was like, it was so traumatizing. It was so scary.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah. To like be unbandaged and think that that was going to be the moment that I'd seen so many other trans guys go through, to be like, oh, it's me. It's finally me. And I was just like, oh no.
Oh gosh.
So I advocated for myself. That was the first time I'd ever like really tried to advocate for myself to get a revision surgery covered by insurance, which is hard to do was hard to do. So I worked 6 months calling my insurance company almost every day.
Wow.
Luckily I had the privilege of I didn't have anything else to do at that point in my life. But I was like maybe a few months sober at the time. So I was going nuts already. And then I was just like, I'm just going to focus on this, I guess. Like, this is my project.
Mm.
And I did get it covered after like appealing their denials, like maybe four times.
Wow.
So it was hard to get covered. And I think that, you know, beyond the like self-actualization of top surgery and the emotional experience of getting such an intense surgery to free myself.
Mm.
It was like, my scars are such a representation of that self-advocacy that I learned how to do at that time in my life. And my revision surgeon was so good that my scars were going away. They were so good. Mm. Like you can see they're so thin. Yeah,
mine don't look like that.
Yeah, most
mine are very dark.
Most don't. Yeah, I love your scars.
Thank you.
And so I started getting like, I started feeling like I was hiding, but I wasn't even trying to, you know? And it was bothering me. It was really bothering me. So I was like, well, I'm already covered in weird tattoos. So like it all just made sense. And then after I posted that, I got a lot of backlash for it from trans men, binary trans men who didn't understand why I would do something like that. Cause it didn't compute in their worldview, in their view of their own transness.
I think that's probably the same type of energy that I received when my scars were really red. Mm-hmm. Right after my surgery, they were red, they were raised, they were kind of like thick and puffy. And I was so unconcerned. Mm-hmm. I was like, don't you see? I don't have boobs. Like,
yeah.
This is great. Like, I do not care.
Yeah.
Like, this is where I'm at and this is great. And I was like, maybe they'll fade and maybe they won't. And we'll go along with them, right?
Yeah.
But so many people were like, and it was trans people, it was cis people, it was everybody that was like, here's how you can fix your scars. Like, don't you know you can get laser? And like, this happened for more than a year. Every once in a while now, I still get a comment, actually fairly frequently. It's like, why does your scar look like that? And people will say, I don't want my scar to look like that. Or they'll ask me like, what did you do in your recovery? Because I don't want mine to look like yours.
Dang.
And I like, you know, I think that as I say it, I'm like, wow, that's really mean.
That's so mean.
but I will say that I haven't received it as mean. I think initially I was bothered because I was just annoyed. I was like, why are you telling me what to do with my body? The whole point of this, like, I thought we all agreed that we weren't going to tell people what to do with their bodies.
No.
Yeah. But beyond that, I actually realized, and this helped me a lot, that they were saying it out of love. And I know it sounds kind of funny, but I think it's because they don't recognize that I could love myself even with it.
Right.
Or that it's part of why I love myself is that I fought this hard to be where I am. And I've learned to take that rejection of my choices or my body or how my body healed or whatever as self-preservation for them. Right. It's like, oh, you know, with your, for example, your tattoos, it's scary to them, to anybody who doesn't have the grounding to be able to be like, ah, this is actually okay.
Right. And I also think that there's a level of like privilege that comes with being able to be so proud of something that really does out me as trans. And so I do recognize that like it is a privilege to be able to be like, no, I want to be seen as trans because I walk through the world unafraid of being visibly trans. And there's a reason because I'm not really in danger. I've never been targeted because I'm trans. In the real world. Sure. On the internet, I've had so many, you know, so much hate.
Right. Yeah. But hiding like, behind the keyboard.
Right. And like, you know, in the real world, whatever, it's all the real world.
In the physical world.
In the physical world. There we go. The physical world. The thing I'm the most targeted for is the fact that I'm a feminine guy. I get called the F word.
I see.
A lot.
Right. Novel, very creative of people.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I'm like, oh, original. I self-proclaim with that word. So it's not real. I know that they're trying to sling it as a hateful thing, but I'm just like, okay, like, cool.
I like that you brought up privilege. I think it's something that I always want to be reminded of is the privileges that I walk through the world with. And I think I've even had people argue with me about my own gender, right? Mm-hmm. Where I'll be like, sometimes I'll say that I'm trans and people will be like, no, you're not. You're
oh
like,
yeah.
I don't believe Classic. You. Like you can't possibly, you're too whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Insert something about manhood.
Yeah. You have a beard.
Yeah. Oh my
Your
God.
Your beard's thicker than mine.
Oh, it's so unfair.
Yeah.
But that actually has happened my whole life, having to defend gender. And I was wondering if you had this same experience when I was a kid. I dressed very much like the boys did. I had short hair. I wore boys' clothes, whatever boys' clothes are, right? And if I was in a place where my mom wasn't or my friends weren't, I wouldn't correct people, right? So if they called me, you know, he, him pronouns at the skate park, which was one of my favorite places to go, I would not correct them.
Yeah.
And I even would like confide in my brother. I'd be like, don't correct them. Please don't tell them that I'm your sister.
That's
Let's just like, can we just leave it? Oh. And he would just leave it because who cared? We were at the skate park.
Right.
We're there for 3 hours, whatever, move on. But there was this like, there was this sacredness of going to the skate park because I just got to be a sweaty little boy like all the other boys.
Yeah.
But there would be times where I had to disclose my gender. For example, tennis camp. I went to this like silly tennis camp one summer for a week and I hated it. I'm terrible at tennis. And we did this thing where whatever we were hanging out. All the boys thought I was also a boy. I was just leaving it. And I went by Sky at the time because I thought that was fun.
All right, that's cool.
And it was like my boy name for some reason, even though also Skylar is a, anyways.
Yeah.
So I went by Sky and all the boys thought I was a boy. And then there was a moment, the dreaded moment where my stomach dropped because the coach said, okay, girls go over here and boys go over here.
Uh-huh.
And they separated us. And I like froze and I stood there and all the boys ran off. They were like, come on, come on, come on. Like, you know, to me. And I knew I just couldn't. Like, I couldn't. And I knew that the coach had a name on it, said my gender on it too. Right. So I stayed and they were like, they were like, what are you doing? Why are you staying? And I was like, I'm a girl. Like, I was like, I did not, I couldn't say it, you know, but I had to. And I did. And they were like, they thought I was joking. They completely thought I was joking. And I got to the point of almost pulling down my pants
Jeez.
To show them Whoa. That I wasn't, quote, a boy. to the, you know, I literally put my hands on my pants. I was about to pull my pants down. They were like, no, 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 no. And they ran off.
Wow, that's so bold. We would have been friends.
I didn't know what else to do.
We would have been friends.
But I probably, but I did that so often, not the pulling down the pants,
yeah.
But many times having to try to prove that I was this girl, which mm-hmm. I hated. It was yeah. so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
To the point where people thought I was a trans girl.
Whoa.
And that was a mind
yeah.
twister. I was like, how did I get here? Did you have experiences like that?
I wouldn't say so. I think that, you know, I wasn't passing in that way.
I see.
Even though I was definitely shopping in the boys section and like people would taunt me with calling me a boy, but no one was ever convinced that I was a real boy. I was a really pretty girl. And I think they saw my potential and wanted me so badly to lean in. I had three sisters growing up and they were all really feminine and they all their names started with the letter A and they were just like, very like, I don't know. It was just, like very much like them versus me, even though we were all girls and I was the youngest and I was ostracized a lot. I spent so much time by myself as a kid. And you know, I think because everybody in my life saw the potential for me to be like this, to be like them. It was like, I wasn't like far enough to the like mask side to really like pass or like blend in. I always stood out. Even though I really did, I remember one time my sister won a pair of boxers at a birthday party. Like it was like, I don't know how she-
A gag gift or something?
Yeah, it was a gag gift.
Okay.
But they were super cool. They had like spider webs. Like they were black with spider webs on them.
I loved boxers when I was a kid.
Same. And I would ask my parents to buy me boxers and, but these were like-
The cool ones.
They were like skater boy boxers,
right,
you know?
Right. The kind you had to have above your pants a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
Yeah, which is like such a gender euphoria moment for me still. Like I still do that. But I remember, so I had these like zippy pants, the kind that are like cargo pants that you like unzip at the knee.
Oh my God, I wore those exclusively.
Me
as
too.
A child. Okay,
I
perfect.
I like wore them and then I wore the like extra fabric around my ankles because that's what the boys did at my school. And it was like cool. It was like very cool.
Okay.
And so I was getting my zippies on and then that's what I called them. And then I was like, oh my God, I could wear the boxers under the zippies and then like sag at school. And I was like so excited to like try it.
Mm.
And I put the boxers on and then I almost had the pants up when my mom walked into my bedroom and was like gonna tell me to like, you know, we had to go. And I just remember like frantically just like stripping everything off while she like was opening the door because I was so scared of her like catching me, even though my mom was pretty supportive of like my gender exploration as a kid. She's the one that took me shopping. Like she bought me those pants. But like I had already internalized the shame.
Right, right.
I already knew it was wrong.
Right.
Because I was taunted for it already. So like there was this such a like battle inside of me wanting so badly to stay true to myself and like keep doing the thing that felt so good to do. And I didn't know why. And I didn't want to question it. I was a kid.
I didn't want to question it. Oh,
you
man.
Know,
but we're forced to question it.
Yeah. And like, I was like, I don't want to defend this thing. I don't want to explain myself. I was 10. Like, let me wear what I'm wearing. But at that point, it wasn't even someone telling me. It was already internalized. Because my mom wouldn't have said a word about it. She would have just been like, oh, cool. Like, she was really like that, you know?
Do you remember when you started internalizing that? Like, where did you, I don't know if you can remember the first moment.
When I was 8, my parents divorced. My dad remarried 3 months after the divorce. So it was really fast. Everything changed. And he remarried this woman from Mexico. And my dad's Mexican. He's from Mexico. He married a woman from Mexico that had been previously married to his brother, which was
Okay.
So she was my aunt at one point, then turned stepmother, and okay. she brought along two sisters.
Gotcha.
For me.
Okay.
So two daughters. The oldest was 4 years older than me, and she was my first bully. So I was 8 and a half, and she decided that because my hair was short and I wore boys' clothes, that I was like this disgusting thing. And I didn't know curse words before her. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it meant to be called gay as a derogatory thing. I didn't understand what she was doing or why she was hurting me, and why she felt so compelled to make sure that I knew that I was different, and that like all the reasons why I was different were the reasons why she felt justified in hurting me. And so it was very quickly learned and internalized. It happened within a week.
Right, right. Very explicit. At
that yeah. time. Jeez. Yeah.
I'm thinking about all the ways that we internalize, right? And one mm-hmm. of them, like you said, is that explicitness where people just say this is wrong, and they make you feel
right.
You know, like it's bad. And then I think we learn those and then we use them, right, repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And the first time I remember feeling that shame was not, it was because of my mom, but not because of my mom. Mm-hmm. And what I mean is that when people would call me a boy, because I had the short hair and I wore the boys' clothes, whatever, my mom would get so mad and she'd be like, this is my daughter.
Yeah.
And she thought she was protecting me. I have so much love for my mom. My mom, I have a great relationship. But awesome. At the time, you know, it was this like, it was, I don't think she definitely didn't understand what she was doing. And I didn't understand why I felt the way that I did. Cause I think she thought she was protecting me. She was defending me. And yet what I received was shame.
Right.
Right. And so it's so interesting because it's so such different experiences that we had. You had a very explicit shaming and I had a very implicit shaming, right. But we both learned that way. Well, this whole wanting to be a boy thing, or really just being a boy,
yeah.
Was so bad. There was something so wrong about yeah. it. But I really love what you said about not wanting to question. I hadn't even ever thought about that way. Mm. Because when I was a kid, I didn't have the words of I am a boy. Right. I had tomboy as well.
Right.
Actually one day I called myself Tommy the whole day because I was like, no, I am Tommy. I'm not a tomboy. I'm Tommy. That's I literally, so cute. I like called you know, when a teacher comes in and it's like a substitute teacher and so yeah. they don't know your names. I like before the teacher came in, I corralled the whole classes in fourth grade, my science class. And I corralled the whole class where I was like, okay, guys, I'm going to tell the teacher my name's Tommy and that Skylar's not here. Nobody correct her. And they were like, nobody cared. We were yeah. fourth grade. What? I don't care. They think yeah. it's funny too. So they let me. And the whole class, I got to be called Tommy one day for 1 hour. Wow. At the time though, I didn't have the words. I didn't have the explanation, but mm-hmm. I think I felt that I needed mm-hmm. to explain why it was that I didn't feel like the other tomboys. Like there was a group of girls in my school mm-hmm. who all have persisted in their girlhood, unlike me. Yeah. And I remember being lumped into them and being like, oh, you know, Skylar and the other tomboys. And I was like, no. There's something different. Like mm. I am not like them. And there was something so clear about it, but I couldn't find the words for it. I actually am a boy. But I feel like I had to find if I couldn't explain it, then I couldn't be it.
Right. Yeah, I definitely relate to the, like, if I can't explain myself, then I don't deserve to be it. Mm. It was like, so I came out when I was 17. I came out as trans. I was already out as a lesbian since I was like 15 and a half or something. And I had a queer group of friends. I was really immersed in the queer community in Santa Barbara where I grew up. And my best friend was a trans guy.
Wow.
And he passed without testosterone, without anything, without even binding. He passed. He just was one of those guys that just like had a super deep voice and just was like, when he was like, I'm a boy, everyone was like, yeah, we know. So it was like very easy for him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was his best friend and I was so happy for him when he came out. And I, you know, soon after he came out, I came out and nobody believed me. And because I couldn't explain why I was feminine mm. and I dressed like a boy, I had, like, I was a dyke. Like that's how I identified. I was a dyke through and through. I did look masculine, but imagine the way that I speak now, but with a voice that's not on testosterone. You know, I have feminine mannerisms. And because of those reasons, my queer group of friends were like, no, you're doing that for attention. Like, you don't, no.
Oh my God.
Absolutely not. And they didn't call me my name that I wanted to be called. They didn't use my pronouns. And I felt so at a loss for how to explain myself that I just was like, oh, just kidding. Like, I don't know what I was drunk. And I was, when I came out to them, I was like really drunk. And I just kind of played it off as like this joke. And yeah, I think that like, we are so pressured to know exactly who we are before we tell anyone, because we know that we're going to be questioned and we're going to be asked to defend what we're saying with like hard evidence. And we don't always have that.
And other people don't either.
Right.
Right. Like, I think as you were talking, I was thinking like, as I think, you know, and as you have had the experience too, I do a lot of things public facing and mm-hmm. therefore press facing, especially sure. with trans athlete stuff. And I am constantly over filtering everything I'm saying, fearful that somebody's going to take it and twist it. And as you were talking about, you know, this like, oh, I'm not sure. And then zinging back, I was like, part of my brain went, forgetting it's my own podcast where we're not going to edit it weirdly, but part of my brain went, oh my God, what if they take that? Right. Yeah. And shift that around to like
absolutely.
Not being sure and whatever, trans people shouldn't be sure. And there is this, even now, yeah. right? I'm so conditioned to consider certainty, right? And consider the absoluteness that we must present in order to be valid, in order to be received, in order to be believed. And I want so badly for us and actually everybody to not have to be sure, mm-hmm. right? To allow ourselves to stumble. What happens if you weren't sure? Like, let's say you really weren't sure. It sounds like you have been for a long time, but even if you weren't sure about your identity or whatever, okay. Like yeah. what would have been so bad if you had said, hey, I'm trans, and then later been like, whoops.
Yeah. Yeah. I honestly, like, I think that there's such a lack of representation of trans mask or trans people in general in our community who are out and have a platform, who feel brave enough to say that out loud, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. because there are still so many folks out there who aren't out or who are just like just beginning to have these like questioning moments, who probably don't feel safe having these questions or like not being sure, not being certain. I get so many messages from folks being like, I didn't know that I was allowed to identify as trans mask because I was so feminine. Mm. And thank you so much for representing, you know, somebody who is comfortable with their femininity enough to like express openly, because I didn't know I could exist. And I didn't know I could exist either, you know? And that's what kind of pushes me to like be representation out there, because I just think more representation is always good, you know? And I never want to say like that there shouldn't be like masculine trans mask representation just because I think that there should be more feminine.
Yeah, it's not a scarcity. It's a more.
Exactly. It's not always a more. It's always a more. Just like how there's a lot of trans femme representation compared to trans mask representation. And like acknowledging that isn't to say we need less trans femme representation. It's just to say we need more trans mask representation too. And like, thank God for all of it that exists. And let's have more, you know? So like the you know, being a feminine trans mask person is so crucial to me to be visible, because I'm witness to so many people who tell me that it's been life-saving.
I think and that expands beyond transness too. I mean, I think like one of the things I found really powerful is my relationship with cis men, mm-hmm. Who have like found a portion of what we might call femininity through connecting with me that really doesn't have to be femininity either. Right. I mean, all of these are just constructs, but what I mean by that is softness, emotions, mm-hmm. ability to talk about sex without it being conquest and domination, right? And there's just so much there that cis men don't have access to, yeah. or that they stop themselves from having access right. to, that I have watched them broach because of sharing space with somebody who doesn't want to subscribe to those kinds of boxes. I hear through what you talk about, this is related and sort of shifting, but as you talk about femininity, what I was thinking about is I don't think that, well, I don't know what people think about me sometimes, but I don't know. I don't think I'm consistently perceived as like feminine. I think most people perceive me in the masculine side of things ish.
I'd say so.
And I like have such a deep love for my womanhood. And I think one of the things that I never wanted to lose that was like a panic that I was going to lose was my connection to womanhood. And my childhood, my mom is a very strong, like a feminist woman. And my whole childhood, I wanted to be like her. I tried so hard to be this woman that she was. When I like first got my period, it was 4 a.m. and I had to go to practice, swim practice at 4 a.m. And you don't get to wear a pad to practice at 4 a.m. when you're swimming. You have to wear a tampon.
Oh, you went right in.
I went right in. Yeah. And I remember waking up and my mom being like, you got to do this. This is what we do. This is what women have to do. And of course, not all women have periods, but that's not the point here. The core was she had this strength. And I just remember the period part is that she was like, this will not stop you. She was like, so like, whoa. like serious that, and it wasn't even much of a conversation. It was more like I ran to the bedroom because my dad took me to practice and I was like, well, can't talk to you about this.
Yeah.
So I ran to my mom, woke her up and she was like, here you go. This is what you're doing. You got to get going. And she was so adamant that girls could do everything that boys could. And I so appreciated that about her. And so when I began discovering my boyhood and my manhood, I thought I was betraying her. Mm. I thought that this was me losing womanhood, and it was not even losing. It was that I was discarding it. And I think my dad said this to me once, and it broke my heart. He said, "Skylar, what about how did he say it? He said, "Skylar, women are going to be so sad to lose you, and to like lose your womanhood." And I was like, I don't know what. I can't do this now. I was like, I can't transition. What am I going to do? How am I going to, I'm going to lose this part of me that was so central. And as I'm talking about this, what I mean to say actually is that I didn't lose that. And I learned through my transition that I think my womanhood that my mom taught me, that I learned from her and many other strong women, I've carried with me, and it's made me the man that I am. And I love that. I love that so much that my womanhood, I believe my woman has made me a better man. Mm-hmm. And I hear, I think through your expression of your own femininity, and I think your reverence for your femininity and your femininity combined with your masculinity, mm-hmm. I hear a similar feeling.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the way that you're putting that is really powerful and poetic and beautiful. And I just like, I love the way you're talking about it. There's been such a fear that I've had to work through about speaking about this kind of stuff as a trans man, not wanting to be disregarded because of the language I use to describe these feelings, you know, and to just hear you talk so openly and freely gives me permission and gives so many people permission too. And I think that we all do that for each other, you know, the more we speak to each other and aren't in competition with each other, which is another thing that I think
sure.
scarcity. We could touch on, but
sure.
I love just hearing trans mask people talk about their femininity and their connection to that, is so healing. So thank you. I feel like for me, it didn't feel so, it's not tied to a specific person for me or like something I learned. I think for me, it's been mostly guided through recovery and like realizing how much internalized toxic masculinity I was experiencing because of all the years of identifying with, like hyper masculinity to compensate for how like uncomfortable I felt in my body.
Right.
So I was like a misogynistic lesbian. Like I was like a dykey, like player in Santa Barbara. and I carried that with me to college in Oakland. And wore that as a badge of honor because it felt like that was my one thing that tied me to men, to being a man, being like a man, was the way that I could just like discard women. Mm. And it was—
Were you aware of that at the time?
Absolutely. Which is unfortunate because I think the self-awareness adds a level of like, oh, oof. But
well, it doesn't. It doesn't. I think it's also about you trying to find, like, I have a lot of compassion, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Well, not condonement necessarily, but compassion,
yeah,
for what you were, what kind of like love you were trying to find for yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a generation of teens, of queer teens raised by Shane from the L Word. You know, like that was a my representation.
That's so true.
That was like the one person who I could be like, okay, yeah, like they're not, she wasn't hyper masculine. She right. was just butch, like without even really trying. Like she was just herself. And that's how I felt. So I was like, I see myself in this person. And she seems to navigate the world by just having sex with so many people in order to like find, whatever, validation or what affirmation. And it seemed fun. Mm. And it seemed like—
It was painted as fun in that show too.
Yeah, it seemed like something to do, you know? And because I was so, so very lost at that time in my life, it seemed like an identity that I could get behind, that I could engage with. And so, you know, I think I came out as a trans man when I went away to Mills College, which is an all women's college in Oakland. And I had like a slew of horrible experiences there, realizing that I was just not ready for higher education. And I didn't know if I ever would be. And I wasn't, and I wouldn't be. But I am grateful for the experience of realizing that surrounding myself with so many women helped me realize that I just wasn't one.
Right, right.
And it helped me come out again. So I'd gone back in the closet at 17, came back out at 18. So it wasn't that long in between.
Sounds like a painful year though.
It was. It really was. I didn't know if I'd make it through that year. It was, that was the year that I really leaned into my substance abuse and alcohol and all that. So, you know, I do think that like having that as a crutch and as a coping mechanism did save my life, and also was, would later on present itself as an issue.
Sure.
But at the time, you know, like
that's what they called maladaptive, because yeah, they're both adaptive. They help us get through things, and they're also mal. They're not so good for us.
Yeah, not so good for us. Yeah. But I think that like, you know, my history with rejecting femininity, it didn't just affect my relationship with myself. It affected my relationship with women in general, or people in general. And so healing like my hatred for myself and the misogyny that I was inflicting upon myself, and trying to like contain and like suppress and hate that part of me, unlearning that and healing that helped me,
yeah,
you know, with my relationship to women outside of myself.
One of the ways we get removed from access to womanhood, or how do I say this best? Femininity, right? We live in a society, patriarchal society, that is highly misogynistic. And I think that that is so challenging for everybody, actually. But especially in our case, trans masculine individuals who also want to love on that femininity.
Yeah.
But I've found at every turn, no matter which presentation of myself, I think I was demanded by the world to hate my womanhood.
Yeah.
Right, whether that was me in womanhood before I transitioned. Yes, my mom said we need to love this, right? But the world did not, right? The world said, nope, this is not good. Mm-hmm. And then as I learned to, as I transitioned and I learned to accept my manhood, then it said absolutely yeah, no womanhood.
To the extreme.
Right. And you know, God forbid you even have any remnants of that, because yeah, especially for a trans, as you said, for a trans man or trans masculine person, it not only says you're not man enough, it just says you're not man.
Right.
It puts you back into the old category.
Yeah.
And so on my swim team in college, it was a really tough time of me trying to figure out. I knew I wanted to hold on to my womanhood. I knew I wanted, and when I say hold on to womanhood, I don't mean being a woman. I think I'm sure people will twist what I have to say about this and say, "Oh, how are you even trans or whatever?" And they can go and wonder.
We're just two ladies talking. just go away. It's okay.
And I think like it's not a holding on to being a woman. It's what I think I walked through to get here.
Yeah.
And
makes sense.
I think it's one of the reasons I'll never get a hysterectomy, for example.
Interesting.
I feel that that's, unless I need to for like medical, like,
sure, you know,
like if there's something wrong with it, then okay.
Yeah.
But fine. I feel this like, I know this is not every trans person's experience, and I feel the duty to say that absolutely. Some people deeply feel disconnected from their from their uteruses, and that's so valid. I know some people had like the most like best spiritual like releases by getting hysterectomies.
Yeah,
for me, it feels like the place I came from, and it feels there that I feel like my uterus and my parts feel like sort of the last bit of me that's where I came from and truly where I came from. If you think about birth, right. Mm-hmm. And it feels sacred to keep. It feels like an ode to womanhood. It doesn't feel like womanhood because I don't believe that my uterus makes me a woman, right. Or that my parts make me a woman. But they're an ode to what maybe people expected me to be. And perhaps there's beauty in holding all that womanhood entails, especially I come from a line of Korean women that have, you know, escaped war, walked from North Korea to South Korea during the Korean War and the separation. There's just so much power in that. Mm-hmm. And I feel blessed to be a man who holds that.
Cool. That's awesome. I got a hysterectomy and I feel like I'm able to access more love for myself and femininity because of the removal of that.
I love that.
And that's awesome. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's so impossible to generalize these experiences.
Because, I love that you got one for the purpose of having this conversation. Yeah. Right now, cause we have such different experiences. I love it.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, I just think it's cool. I mean, even though I had my experience of like really, feeling, grossed out, quite frankly, by that organ in my body that just felt so dysphoric. It just didn't feel like mine. It's like I can still picture what it might feel like to have an emotional connection with it, because empathy, you know, like it is quite simple for me to like hear your words and be like, oh my gosh, that's so beautiful. It's so profound. And then come back to my experience and be like, oh, it was so easy for me to just be like garbage, like fling, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, it did take some processing.
Sure.
I thought I was going to be a seahorse dad at one point in my life. So, you know, but once I started having some cramping happening because of testosterone stuff, and immediately I was like bedridden, couldn't even think or move or, it was so dysphoric. And I was like, if I can't handle a little knock, like I was like, I can't handle a whole human. There's no way. So it was actually a grieving period for me to get rid of that.
The grieving process for me, I thought that I was going to have to grieve womanhood. Mm. Like I thought that I had to grieve my connection to who I thought I was supposed to be. I thought I had to grieve my connection to my mom. That was really hard. That expectation that I had to grieve that. I thought I had to grieve my connection with my teammates who were women. And what I learned is I actually didn't have to grieve my connection to anything, but sometimes I have had to grieve other people's connection to me. Mm. And what I mean by that is now when I walk around the world, I'm perceived as a man. People don't see my transness, they don't see my queerness, and they don't see my womanhood or my history of womanhood. And sometimes that's wonderful because I want to be seen as myself, and a lot of myself is manhood. But a lot of times that means people are perceiving me as toxic or as scary or as unsafe, especially queer and femme folks. And that breaks my heart. And that is a grieving process. It's like a never ending grieving process. Because I know what it's like to not be perceived as unsafe, but now I'm perceived as unsafe in some situations. And I don't know if you have the same experience or if you have thoughts about that, but like just grieving, I would love to hear about grieving and sort of womanhood and transness. And
I think the one thing I can relate to is the experience of grief, like feeling like fear of grieving my relationships to people. And specifically my sister, my biological sister, which nowadays I really just say I have one sister because that's really the case. And we're very close. She's queer. She's awesome. She's just like my favorite person in the whole world. Like we've just been like such a unit. We were so there for each other as teens. And she's really helped me. She loved my, she taught me how to love me. She really did. So, you know, I was raised as her sister and we were sisters and we like did sister things and like shared a bed and took showers together without even thinking. Like it was just so like, we were just so socialized to be sisters. And, I had an epiphany a few years ago where I was like, I started crying thinking about how like she doesn't think of me as her sister anymore. I'm her little brother. And that was an affirming term at one point in my transition. It was like, it was everything to me that she would call me her brother. And then all of a sudden I was like, ow, like, but what about all those years that we were sisters? We were the girls. And I talked to her about it and she was like, well, I'm not going to call you my sister because that just sounds like I'm being like not accepting of you. And I was like, but who are you doing this for? Are you doing it for them or are you doing it for me? So that was a whole conversation. But grieving that was interesting. And now terminology doesn't hold as much weight for me anymore. Like I said, like with pronouns and stuff, it just feels I've unpacked so much that now I'm just sort of like, I don't want anybody to have power over me with what words they use for me. They want to call me a woman still. I'm going to figure out how to receive that and use it to my benefit, which is such a man thing to do. I don't want anyone to be able to insult me. Mm. And that is a control issue on my end, but also like,
what's survival too?
If I can, why not? Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. But the grief thing, I think for sure grieving that. And then, I don't have the experience of being, seen as an unsafe man. I don't have that experience. I don't know what it is about me. People feel safe around me. Maybe it's because I'm a barber or a hairdresser. People just feel like they can open up to me. I have a softness that I think, it just, I don't know what it is, you know? But I know it's there because I walk through the world and I know people feel really comfortable around me. So, but I know that there is a capacity for people to be afraid because of my masculinity, but I'm like, really? Like, I don't know, you know? And it's something that used to like, the idea of not being masculine enough used to be such a source of pain and self-hatred for me. And it has turned into one of the most, one of my proudest.
Mm. Sounds like you cherish things. It.
I do cherish it. I really do. I love that about myself.
I love that about you.
Oh, well, thank you.
You have been very public, you and Elle, with your relationship online. And I feel so privileged to be able to witness it online because I think it's something that a lot of people feel entitled to other people's relationships, but I feel like it's so sacred. Mm. And I don't share pretty much anything about me and my partner. So I feel like privileged to witness it. Not only because it's your personal life, but also because of the amount of joy and sort of like, I don't know, magnificence that you two show together. And I was curious if you could talk a bit about it, because I think that T for T love, trans for trans love is something that's really special. And I want to share as much about it as I can. And
yeah.
I haven't actually experienced it myself. So tell me what it's like for you.
Well, I think with my relationship with Elle, I've been able to heal so many parts of myself that were buried and hurting. So it wasn't even like I really knew that they were even there, but they were affecting my life in so many ways. So it's like beyond the like trans for trans nature of our relationship, it's just like they are such an exceptional human being that has been able to bring out the most exceptional parts of me. And through like realizing how incredible they are, I was able to like realize those aspects of myself as well, which is just, you know, beautiful in and of itself. And then the trans aspect of it is just like a cherry on top for me, because it's like one less thing to have to explain or worry about. And I hear that a lot from other trans for trans couples, is that like it's just so nice to not have to explain what it feels like to be experiencing dysphoria or whatever it may be. Because it's not that you need to understand dysphoria in order to love a trans person if you're cis. You don't need to. I've had other relationships with cis people who've been so affirming and so able to hold me in my pain when I'm going through whatever I'm going through as a trans person. But there is a level of understanding that it does make a difference.
Mm.
Not to say that it's necessary, but it's nice. It's so nice. And it gives me a comfortability that that has allowed me to like express so authentically and feel loved in such a unique and deep way. I've only been able to like grow exponentially as our relationship progresses. And it's only been, I mean, our anniversary is June 15th. So it's not even been a year. But it feels like we've known each other for so long just because of so many changes that have happened throughout our relationship. And I'm just, oh God, I've never been so happy.
I love that.
I know that this is meant to be. And I didn't believe in that before I met Elle, or before this all started. I really didn't. I was like very shut off to my spirituality, my sense of anything but what I could tangibly
grasp.
See and grasp. And then just having our relationship it just reignited something for me, that a connection to myself that I had lost. So it's all about me. And
that's very powerful. I mean, I think what I'm hearing reflecting, a lot of trans people, I think, don't believe that they're innately lovable.
Yeah.
Or they've been told explicitly that they're not, right? As I think you've told me before that you felt that way. I know that I get, you know, constant comments about that, you know, from many parts of the world. And what I think, you know, whether or not a trans person's in a relationship with another trans person or not, I think there's a core that says that we need to find relationships that make us feel lovable. It's not just that love us, it's make us feel lovable.
Yeah.
And I think I'm hearing that through what you're talking about.
That's so real.
I've been in relationships where I've been loved, I think, but not felt lovable.
Mm-hmm.
And that distinction, I think that experience made me believe in times, especially I dated only cis women so far for long-term relationships. And a lot of those times with women who weren't as affirming as I think I needed, as I deserved and as I have now, were places in which I then felt, okay, this person loves me, but something about me is hard to love.
Oh.
And I think that,
yeah,
eroded me like nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still figuring out. I've been in the relationship I've been in now for a couple of years, and and it's been pandemic, so it feels like a decade.
Yeah,
sure. So I feel like you, I feel like I've known my partner for a very long time, and it's been short, and I'm still piecing apart pieces of me that I banished, mm-hmm. and that those relationships banished as unlovable. Mm-hmm. And what I'm like taking from what you shared, is that we need to find relationships that make us feel lovable and make us love ourselves. And I think that's so powerful. So I thank you.
There's such a level of ease associated mm-hmm. with the feeling of feeling lovable mm-hmm. that I think is really powerful. Mm-hmm. Like I want it to feel easy mm-hmm. to love me mm-hmm. and it's so easy to love them. And, sometimes like I have memories of like having, you know, intense talks with Elle and reflecting that to them, that they are so easy to love. And it heals me to be able to like experience that and share that with somebody and feel the same way. And it's just like, there's something very healing about that. Definitely picked up from past relationships that I was, that was so challenging to understand and to love, and it was, and I should feel so grateful that they were trying, you know,
be in a relationship where somebody doesn't have to try.
Yeah.
Or that their trying is of love and their trying is easy.
Yeah.
You know, like the relationship I'm in now, we both try hard.
Sure.
Because there's many things we don't necessarily understand. It doesn't have to do with transness or gender. It's just that we're different people with different lives.
Yeah. You know?
And so we try, but the trying feels to me, and we're not a perfect relationship by any means, but the trying feels like, of course. It doesn't feel like, oh my God, I have to try.
No.
You know? It's like, of course I'm gonna try. Like this is like how I connect, and so I try. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that the ease. I think that's something I want everything in my life to tend towards ease. And I don't mean easy as in like, oh, it's easy to microwave something versus cook. I mean like ease, like spiritual ease. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. It's the spiritual ease for me.
Mm-hmm. Spiritual mac and cheese you can microwave.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like sometimes, like, I feel like sometimes I'll like, we'll just be hanging out and I'm like, when are we going to have our first fight? Like, I don't know. Mm. We don't know. But it's like, it's because I think the way that we communicate is just aligns so well. And I don't think that that's a requirement for relationships to be healthy. I really don't. But in this case, it is so aligned. It's like, even when we have challenges, there's such a deep commitment to understanding, to wanting to understand, and also prioritizing ourselves, that it's like, I don't know, there's a balance there that just seems to really work, and it's nice, mm-hmm. and I'm happy. And what you see on social media is only half of it, or if anything, like there's like this like feeling that I have to somehow like, I don't know. I want people to know that like what they see of us mm-hmm. is real, and also is just a tiny snippet of how beautiful it really is. Because mm-hmm. it's so good. Yeah.
I love that. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you. I'm happy for you too.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful for this conversation. I'm sort of like perusing over it. I wish I could sit here and like re-listen to it, which I will.
Which you will. And I will too.
But I'm thinking about grief and like our conversation, and I don't want anybody to receive any of the conversation about grief as necessarily bad. Mm-mm. I think sometimes people perceive grief as bad. And I think that grief is so necessary. Mm-hmm. And when I think about grieving womanhood, when I think about grieving how people perceive me, even though it's how I want them to perceive me to some degree, when I think about being perceived as a cis man, which is what I think I was fighting for at one point, but then I'm not. And then they are seeing me as a man, but they're not seeing me because I'm trans. And it's like a little bit of a mind F.
Yeah.
And in that there's grief.
Yeah.
And I don't see it as bad. Like I, this sounds weird, but I want the grief. Like I thrive these days off mm-hmm. of the grief, and it's not bad. It's this grief is this feeling for me that there's a quote that I love that says, grief is love with no place to go.
Mm-hmm. I've heard
and
that
I like
one.
Roll that one over in my head over and over again. And I think about, if grief is love with no place to go, then I have to find a place for the love to go. And where else is it going to go but right back here?
Yeah.
And I think about that all the time when I'm thinking about grief. Like, this grieving of womanhood is really like me trying to redirect the love that I have for myself.
Definitely.
And so I want people to know, at least from my perspective, that when I'm talking about this grief, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's so important. And I don't want it to be different. Like, I don't want to go back and change it.
Right.
Like, I don't regret anything. I love where I am.
I
feel that from you too.
Definitely. I wouldn't change a single thing. And I've been through some horrific things in my 27 years, but I can see exactly how each thing has led me here, and I wouldn't change anything about what's happening here. I live a beautiful life, and probably like 99% of the time I experience a level of joy that I didn't even think was possible. I didn't think it was humanly possible, and especially not possible for me. I did not think I was going to make it past 25. I used to say I'm going to quit smoking when I'm 25 because I did not think I'd make it to 26.
Here you are, 27.
And here I am, 27, and I love it. Mm. I like it.
27 is one of my favorite numbers because it's 3 cubed, 3 to the third.
You know what?
And so weird.
You know, people who like math and are good at it are necessary, and I'm grateful for that. I think that what you said about grief is important to note because of, you know, I don't identify as like an educator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you,
I do.
You do.
Yes.
And I'm so grateful that you do, because what you're doing is so powerful and so important, and I don't want to do it.
A lot of people tell me that.
I bet. But like, the space that I occupy is very innate and easy to occupy for me. And
so
I feel
glad.
Like what you're doing is very in alignment with you. And that's, and it shows, just because of the energy and the consistency that you have for it. Mm-hmm. Like that, it would be clear that it's not in alignment if you couldn't keep it up. And you do. So I'm just really grateful that you're doing what you're doing with your platform and your voice and your passion.
Feeling is very mutual. I'm so grateful for you. And if you had your guitar, I'd make you sing, but we won't make you sing right now. Thank you so much for all that you offered and all that you shared. It means a great deal to me. And I think there's always this like really deep connection I feel with people, especially trans mass folks, because of the similarity of experience, but just generally trans folks who know themselves, right, and who are willing to offer themselves with me, and not be afraid of being judged for it. I think that's so valuable, and I can feel all the work that you've done, and I'm so giddy that I got to meet you there.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Where can people find you?
Oh, you can find me at Ezra Michelle Music on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube, I suppose. If you do that kind of thing. And Spotify, Ezra Michelle on Spotify and iTunes or Apple Music. iTunes. What is this? 2010? Those are the spots.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So glad that you're here. Thank you.
Me too.
We're going to go get me a haircut, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. Awesome.
Let's do it.
Thank you so much, Ezra, for your time, energy, and vulnerability. Sharing space with other transmasculine folks that are able to have these kinds of conversations with me is something that is deeply special. So let's get to the episode's question. How do trans people feel about how we were before? Now, remember, this whole before concept, the before and after characterization of trans people, is incomprehensive, but I do think it's valuable to consider, what were our lives like before we found ourselves, before we accepted ourselves, before we began to show the world a little bit more of who we are? There isn't one answer to this question. There almost never is in these episodes of Dear Skylar, but here are a few things that I am taking away from my conversation with Ezra. The first is a healing of one's relationship with one's body. And I think there's a multitude of different ways that we've done that. Ezra and I talked a lot about our scars and our love for our scars. We talked about the different ways we felt about hysterectomies or lack thereof. A central theme of how we relate to our bodies and how we've healed our relationship to our bodies, especially through this very narrow concept of what gender was supposed to be or what we were taught gender was supposed to be. The second is a deep undoing of internalization, and maybe even internalization we didn't know was there. Ezra and I connected about having this feeling that there was something wrong with our gender. Our gender was somehow bad. Ezra said, and I didn't want to question it, it being his gender, how he was presenting himself. He said, I was a kid. I don't want to defend this thing. I don't want to explain myself. Let me wear what I'm wearing. And I think this expands beyond what we wore or how exactly we presented ourselves. It was about who we were. And I think getting to a place where we don't question ourselves is deeply difficult when there's all of these rules that we've been steeped in to tell us who and how we were supposed to be. The successful undoing of internalization, in my opinion, is that lessening of questioning, that lessening of doubt, and just being. This leads to the third answer to the question of how we feel about how we were before and really how we connect with ourselves, how we learn to heal and find ease, connection with the parts of ourselves that have been avoided, erased, exiled is deeply important. And those parts of ourselves that are avoided, erased, and exiled are usually parts of ourselves that gender as a construct, gender as everybody expects it to be, has forbidden us from accessing. Lastly, and this was something I was reflecting on as Ezra spoke about his relationship with Elle and a bit from last week's episode of listening to Elle speak about their relationship with Ezra, was this concept of trying to tend towards ease. That ease includes experiencing and holding ourselves through grief, giving ourselves compassion for it. It also involves understanding that our paths to where we are today are not linear, that we are compilations of all that we have been, all that we are, and all that we will become. While much of our conversation surrounded our transness and the fact that we were once perceived as women and now as men, I think there is universality about gender and our experiences with gender that anyone, regardless of whether or not they are trans, can connect with. And this universality I'm talking about here is actually gender as belonging, or rather engaging with gender presentation, with gender roles, with our own understandings of our gender as tickets to belong, as a way to find our own belonging, our own understanding of belonging. And I think the more we can have compassion and kindness and gentleness with ourselves with regards to our gender, the more we can find that spiritual ease. Again, I'm so grateful for Ezra for his time. If you're looking for him, you can find him, like he said, Ezra Michelle Music on Instagram, on YouTube, on TikTok. He also has handscreen printed merch available on his Instagram shop. And if you live in LA, you can request an appointment for a haircut with him if you're looking for a gender affirming barber. Ezra actually cut my hair a couple months ago after we recorded this podcast episode, and it was a lovely, very gender affirming experience. I'm so grateful for people like him. Come back next week for another episode of Dear Skylar.